You're listening to CJSF Radio, Simon Fraser, 90.1 FM.
You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery, professional engineer, professional futurist, and sometimes occasional sessional instructor of future studies at Simon Fraser University. And this is a weekly show that looks at future trends and issues and important items that affect your daily life and will be affecting your life into the future. Welcome to the show. We're continuing our look at the book, The Mind of the CEO, which looks at the future of the corporation, by Jeffrey E. Garton. Last show, you're looking at the chapter, A Vision Without Execution is an Hallucination. The struggle to turn dreams into reality takes place on many levels. Even if you have a sense of what's around the corner, if you don't have a team in place to execute your plan, then there's a big problem, according to CEO Stephen Case. Quote, "In the end, a vision without the ability to execute it is probably an hallucination." One aspect of execution is the setting of fundamental principles for decision-making. In large, decentralized organizations, no matter how strong the leadership at the top is, the effective execution of a plan requires purposeful action in many parts of the company. Broad guidelines, operating principles are needed for all levels of management to use in making decisions in a rapidly shifting environment. Said Orit Gadirish, quote, "You can't have a long-term strategy anymore because with it, you're going to be confined and you won't be able to move fast enough to adapt. What strategy is now is how you allocate your resources, which also means how you decide what not to do. And when I say resources, I don't just mean capital. I mean your time as an executive, where you put your most talented people, and where you put your brand name. And so, if you do not have infinite resources, you need, and you definitely have to have, strategic principles." Gadish cited Jack Welch as someone who has established effective strategic guidelines. When Welch took over GE in 1981, he decreed that all of GE's companies would have to either number one or be number two in their respective global markets. He didn't tell the heads of these companies how to get there. But he made it clear that he wouldn't support businesses that failed to achieve this worthy goal. Lawrence Weinbach of Unisys also illustrates the way strategic principles can be used. Weinbach came to Unisys in 1997 from an 8-year stint as chief executive of the combined accounting and consulting firm Anderson Worldwide. His job at Unisys, where he holds the titles of chairman, president, and CEO, was to turn around a flagging performance. He is determined to make the most out of globalization by subjecting his entire product development and marketing operations to a standard. Will a Unisys product sell in most of the 100 or so countries in which the company does business? I understand full well that different countries are going to change at different speeds. But because of globalization, the time it takes for country X to catch up to country Y has been vastly reduced. And so, I want to concentrate only on products and services that can be used in many countries over a reasonable period of time. To be a global company, we can't think of one-off products. Things that sell in just the US or just Malaysia, for example. We have to be convinced that we can replicate the product in at least 50 countries sooner or later, or else you wonder whether the investment is worth it. American Express's Kenneth Chenault is another business leader that uses strategic principles to give guidance to his ubiquitous organization. Quote, "The idea around here is that there should be clear criteria for making big decisions. We call this principle-based decision-making. To deal with the changes that are occurring at such a rapid pace, the rule books simply don't work anymore. When things have gone wrong, what I find is that we have not established the appropriate criteria." He described three principles that he has established for all of Amex's employees. First, they have to meet the test of providing superior value to their customers. They have to ask themselves questions such as, do we really understand what our customers actually want? And do we really understand the competition? Second, they have to satisfy themselves that they are the best in the relevant category when it comes to a combination of costs, revenues, and margins. And third, they must be sure they can add to the American Express brand. Amex executives have to measure their decisions against all three criteria. What I have found is that getting people to apply criteria and thinking them through is not an easy task. But once you do it, the power it gives an organization is incredible. In late 1999, Steve Ballmer, then president of Microsoft and now the CEO, was asked by a New York Times reporter how his firm planned to make money from selling software over the internet. "I don't know," he said. "But if you wait to have a business model in place, you'll be the last guy in the marketplace." When it comes to execution, CEOs are clearly preoccupied with the importance of having to make up their minds very quickly with only a fraction of the relevant information. Quote, "If we want to be leaders," Lawrence Weinbeck told me, "we're going to have to make decisions with maybe 75% of the facts that we'd like to have. If you wait for 95%, you're going to be a follower and not a leader. But you can't will speed," he explained. "Your entire production system has to be geared to it." He described Unisys's technology platforms, how they were built and nearly complete, but in such a way that they could be customized very quickly. Michael Armstrong put it another way, quote, "In the end, you have to have the guts to make a decision," he once told executive recruiters Thomas Niff and James Citrin. Quote, "You'll never have all the data you need. You'll never be able to sort through all of the alternatives and risks that are in front of you. You get the right information and couple it with the right instincts to enable you to make a decision. Then you energize your organization to make that decision and work in the marketplace." Armstrong further explained that in the old AT&T, there was a drive to minimize uncertainty with unlimited analysis. Quote, "Yet the effort to create a 100% solution ensured that the decision was always too late because the market had simply changed. You have to accept that you'll be wrong sometimes, but in the long run you'll suffer more from consistently delayed decisions. It is a proposition from which Kenneth Cheneau agrees. Quote, I think the premium needs to be placed on speed. We talk about the conflict between speed and perfection. And one of the things I have said to organizations is that focus has to be on speed. That does not mean that we want to come out with shoddy products or inferior products. But the reality is, if we take too long to get it perfect, it simply won't matter. The obsession with speed is widespread. Michael Bonsignor said, quote, I think a lot of companies can get hung up on the analytical. I don't think there is time for this because things are moving all the time, and you have to decide what you think the world will look like with all the information that you'd like to have. Martin Sorrell said, quote, I have a bad quote which I nevertheless agree with. A bad decision on Monday is better than a good one on Friday. What bedevils our business is simply a lack of speedy responses. PepsiCo's Roger Enrico said, when you are faced with a decision, the best thing is to do the right thing. The next best thing is to do the wrong thing. And the worst thing is to do nothing. Strategic principles may be necessary, and speed of decision making may be more important than ever. But they both assume an exquisite level of teamwork, which itself presupposes common understandings about corporate goals. Virtually every CEO emphasized to me that execution requires extraordinary communication efforts. Today there is so much information traveling so fast that getting a message out and heard among the clatter is a tremendous undertaking in itself. Multiple constituencies have to get the message. The information has to be clear and consistent. For with today's technology, everyone gets the word at around the same time. It has to penetrate the barriers of different nationalities and cultures. Discrepancies in what is delivered to different audiences will be quickly noted, and confusion can arise and spread quickly, compounding itself in a way from which it seems almost impossible to recover. Being a great communicator entails many traits. You need to connect with people on a number of levels, each of which summons a slightly different skill. You have to present a dignified and authoritative persona. Yet you have to be highly personal and often informal, for even in an era of easy mass communication, any message is received only one person at a time. You have to understand complicated technical issues, yet simplify the concepts for the general public. You need to be receptive to a wide range of questions, yet maintain control over the message you want to deliver. You need to be a champ with audiences from your own industry, but your base of knowledge must be much, much broader. For global executives are constantly being asked in public about their views on trade, on finance, and on the course of the economy. Today's top business leaders need to be effective in getting their points across in multiple national cultures. How John Brown, Jordan Shrimp, Martin Sorrell, Hiroshi Okuda play in the United States is important on how they come across in their home countries. The same could be said of Stephen Case, Michael Dell, Frederick Smith, and their effectiveness in communicating in places such as France, China, or South Africa. CEOs need to reach their employees often in the way that Jack Welch does with his incessant handwritten notes, phone calls, and emails, all of which give the sense that he is everywhere at once. It's a technique that Rolf Breuer has begun to use as well. Quote, my ability to reach all 90,000 of our employees is limited, of course. So what can I do personally? A lot of things, apparently. For example, what I have is a personal email by the name of Employer Line. Every employee can reach me directly. I guarantee that he remains anonymous, and he gets an answer within a week. For years, Roger Enrico, chairman and CEO of PepsiCo, has invited teams of up-and-coming managers to his Western Ranch to bond, brainstorm, and think about their goals. There are two things I try to get across, he told me. You know this question, but whether you're born with leadership skills or do you learn them? I want them to believe that however you got it, if you practice and work on it, you can become better at it. And the second thing I want them to walk away with is that there's no mystery about how this corporation is run. No one is on a pedestal. If there's such a thing as a club, then they are in it. During the week, I spend 2 one-on-one sessions with each of the participants where I can walk about I can talk about anything that they want, including their career or their life. Then there is the critical issue of being direct and specific, but also being able to provide the all-important context. John Brown talked to me about the dual functions of communicating en masse and communicating with individuals. Quote, it's a big challenge because the agenda is always shifting for large groups and for their members, he said. The most important thing a leader can do is communicate, is to keep a bigger picture in focus and to set the context, to explain or reconcile the complexities that cloud the overall picture that's important and why. He emphasized that both the public and the employees need to know what the company is trying to do, how it is doing it, how important any one event or activity is in the larger scheme of things. He used as an example the extensive press coverage in 1999 of BP's investments in Siberia, which at the time were doing poorly because of disputes with BP's Russian partners. A major event in the company's fortunes? Yes, he said. It's important, however, that we're carrying just under $300 million of investment there. And in the scale of our operations, that's tiny. We have a strategic interest in the region. But if we have to write off the investment, no one should think that we have diverted any significant resources. That the context, which I wanted everyone to understand. Another good example of providing context is a 5-page letter to Harvey Golub, chairman and CEO of American Express, who sent all of his employees in September of 1999. The financial markets were being rocked by the combination of the Asian economic crisis, Russian defaults on its debts, and the collapse of long-term credit management, one of America's largest hedge funds. President Clinton was calling this the worst economic crisis in half a century. American Express employees stationed around the world were understandably nervous about the position of their company, which was highly invested in global markets, as well as their own personal futures. Given the extraordinary volatility of worldwide equity markets in recent weeks, the letter said, quote, we wanted to share with you our perspective on the performance of American Express stock and on the current state of our business. Golub went on to discuss the volatile performance of the stock market, the impact on other companies like American Express, the actual performance of Amex's businesses, and some of its plans to deal with the situation. The letter provided a broad perspective. It gave Amex employees, and by extension, all of Amex other constituencies, a measure way to assess the overall position of the firm. In providing a context for the crisis, it did something else. It showed that the company's leaders were doing everything they could, looking at the short term as well as the long term. You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby, and you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery, Instructor of Future Studies at Simon Fraser University. We're now going to take a short break and listen to a very important public service announcement.
With thousands of homeless animals entering SPCA shelters each year, pet overpopulation is a serious problem in BC, but it's one you can help prevent. Spay or neuter your companion animal today. From our perspective, every homeless animal on our streets or in our shelters is one too many. For more information on spaying and neutering initiatives, visit the BC SPCA website at www.spca.bc.ca.
Welcome back. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery, professional futurist. Welcome back. We are looking at the book, The Mind of the CEO, which is an examination of the future of the corporation by Jeffrey E. Garton. We're on the chapter, A Vision Without Execution is an Hallucination. When technology is changing so rapidly and the boundaries of markets are expanding, when competition from old and new rivals is white hot, when your customer base and pool of talent are both restless, when you have to move at lightning speed, when all of this is the case, then executing strategy often leaves leaders no choice but to take some big risks. CEOs console themselves by making the most educated judgments they can. But the fact is, they need to move in both directions, and the only a fraction of the information that's vital to them and a lot of instinct. It's the only way to win in the middle of an industrial revolution. It's also inevitable that some of the big decisions will turn out to be wrong. Many kinds of huge bets are taken today. Bets on technology, bets on markets, bets on the optimum size of the company. Many bets of CEOs concern the internet. Jorma Olilia, Nokia, is already thriving thanks to the ability of cell phones to connect to the internet. But Olilia is sure this is not the end of the game for the world's largest producer of cell phones. And his calm demeanor belies his intense examination of what is coming down the road as wireless handsets and internets link up. Quote, in the next 5 years, it's hard to know how our industry will be evolving, he said. It's going to be one where the value chain will be dominated by software and applications and services. And if we as a company, which is primarily a hardware manufacturer, have to be a major player, or is this an industry where we can continue to thrive as a supplier of headsets, constantly improving our performance in that area? The point is, we really don't know how the industry will develop and who the key players in software and applications for wireless headsets will be. The AOLs, the Microsofts, the Yahoos, the Motorolas, there are lots of candidates for that space. Do we jump into that? We have to decide on the issue of where real value will be added in the future. It's a big decision for us. And indeed, it is. By the fall of 2000, the mobile communications industry was in the throes of a great uncertainty. What kind of data and other services would be available? Who would apply that information? Was a question that CEOs of many industries and investors of all kinds were nervously wondering about. As Olia predicted, new competitions and competitors with different skills were entering Nokia's space. For example, Dell, Palm, Sony, Toshiba, others. Olia had no more time to ruminate. He had to roll the dice soon. Michael Armstrong has made some huge bets in his life. Since being chairman and CEO of AT&T in 1997, he has been endeavoring to create a totally new company. In 1998, Armstrong set out to transform the old Ma Bell, which had failed to innovate and had become a laggard in the internet age. Amid many acquisitions, Armstrong's biggest moves were to buy the cable companies TCI and Media One for $110 billion, to become the country's largest cable provider so that he could handle all of the long and long-distance phone services, internet and TV for any given customer, rendering just one bill to each customer. By any measure, the transformation was a highly ambitious goal because it assumed the success of unproven technologies and a complicated alliance strategy with other cable companies. It also relied on a near flawless execution of wholesale upgrading of existing systems. Quote, if he succeeds, he'll be the hero of AT&T that Lou Gerstner was to IBM, wrote Janet Guyon in Fortune magazine. If he doesn't, he'll be remembered not as the guy who saved AT&T, but as the one who finally ran it into the ground. By the middle of 2000, the bet was looking even bigger. While Armstrong has been staking the future on the growth of wireless and cable communications, he had also been assuming that the traditional long-distance business, a cash cow, would provide time for the change. The latter was losing steam, however, which raised questions about whether the long-distance operation ought to be sold off. There was even speculation in the press about whether AT&T itself could be safe. The pressure on Armstrong was mounting. For the first time since he took over as chairman in the fall of 1997, he wrote Seth Snilzel in the New York Times, quote, Mr. Armstrong himself is on the defensive. His bet the company vision to transform AT&T by delivering a package of interactive digital television, high-speed cyberspace access, and local television service over cable television lines is still largely just that, a vision. At the end of October, AT&T stock was sinking fast, and the company had lost $70 billion of its value since the beginning of the year. The pressure was too great for Armstrong, who was forced to announce that he was splitting the company into four separate parts in order to unlock the value that he felt the market wasn't recognizing. He told a group of analysts that the breakup was the next logical step in his strategy. He only considered the press accounts that he was in retreat not only wrong but offensive. But the Wall Street Journal, echoing virtually every other commentary from the media and Wall Street analysts, said on the day after the split-up was announced, the sweeping restructuring, an admission that AT&T's recent strategy had failed. Only time will tell who is right. We're going to be looking at this in much more detail in future shows, so please stay tuned.
You have been listening to Future Talk on CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby, and Future Talk is a weekly show on important issues that affect you and your future. And this is Dr. Teneri, professional futurist, reminding you that if you're not willing to make the effort to invent your own future, then others will be only too happy to invent it for you. See you next week.
Listening to CJSF Radio, Simon Fraser, 90.1 FM.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, SFU's community radio station broadcasting live from Burnaby, BC.